Well, welcome everybody to the fifth general session already. It's kind of funny on Thursday night when we first get started, it seems like it's going to be so far away and all of a sudden we're here. So I want to welcome everybody to the afternoon session. And we're going to start off by seeing if there are any announcements that people would like to make. So just a quick note on the schedule. We're going to be starting off with the blind history lady, Peggy Chong, and she's going to talk about a glimpse into our past. And then it sounds like we may go to the, depending on what happens, but we may go to the future of advocacy first. That would be our 3 p.m. Panel would be moved up. So we'll see. Anyway, let's just give it a minute. Any announcements? Well, it's just okay. About one.
Rob, go ahead, yeah, Steve. Rob, this is Steve. Just want to mention again, because we didn't put it in the program, but after the banquet tonight, we're going to be having a virtual happy hour. Drinks are on you, but the company is on us, and Joe Green is going to facilitate that on the pre-convention Zoom link that we used right after the banquet. And just been confirmed, yes, the AI panel is moving up to 1:45, so that'll be the schedule change.
That will be okay. That's a definite. All right. Just a quick note, we do have an email address for those of you who are listening on ACB Media 8. We have a mailbox called ask@ccbnet.org. So if you have questions, Steve is monitoring that. And it's primarily intended for those who can't raise their hands here in Zoom, although it's also been used for passing information along as well. So there's a couple of good options there. And we've had a few questions so far in that mailbox. So anyway, if there's no objection to starting a little bit early, I think we'll go ahead and do that. So let me turn it over to the history lady, Peggy Chong. She'll get us going. Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate very much. I want to apologize, first of all, because I know I'm going to cough. It seems I've caught my summer cold. And wouldn't you know, it just happens to be right now in full bloom. So I'm sorry. I've had my honey, got my cough drops here, all that good stuff. So let me just start out by telling you a little bit about who I am and why I got started with blind history, and then go into a few things about California that I thought you might be interested in. I started with blind history because about, the late 1970s, so that tells you that I'm not a spring chicken, I was told to clean out files at the Minnesota Home for the Blind. And I was told just keep the essentials, get rid of all the rest because we had a lot of paper. Boy, I regret throwing out all that paper today. But in the meantime, I was going through some of the old letters from the 1920s and ran across a letter from one of the Minnesota Organization of the Blind members to another, saying, I just met with our blind congressman over the Robbins bill. And I'm thinking, what blind congressman? I didn't know there was a blind congressman. And, you know, I'm in my 20s and stuff. I kind of think I know it all at the time. So it was kind of a shock to me because I'd grown up in the blind community all my life. I knew the blind rug weavers, the blind door-to-door salesmen. My mother went to the North Dakota School for the Blind. I knew her classmates. And I never heard anybody talk about any blind politicians. So I put that aside and started paying a little more attention to stuff. That's how I got started. I went to research that blind congressman and found out that he was Thomas David Shaw from Minnesota, who was congressman from 1914 to 24 when he was then elected to the U.S. Senate and was killed in office. I've had the pleasure of interviewing his daughter-in-law and his grandson, and they tell me that they are convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that Thomas David Shaw was assassinated by the mafia arm of the Democratic Party. And if you look back, they've got some pretty good reasons to think that. And that is a whole story in and of itself, of which I'm not going to get into because he's not from Minnesota. But he was aspiring to greater things and very inspiring as a person. I don't think I would have liked him very much for a close friend, but he was working on issues for the blind early on. He had a service animal, a dog guide. By 1926 or 7, there was a school in Minnesota that had dogs, and he was one of the first recipients of the Dog Lux. And he got a lot of attention for that. He tried to get legislation to allow Lux to ride in the passenger cars rather than in the baggage car. And Thomas David Shaw was not a quiet person. And he usually got the dog to ride in the passenger car with him, but usually he was throwing his weight around while doing that. When I go to research people, I do it as a genealogist. And why I do that is because about 1999, I wanted a project to keep me busy during the winter. So I decided I was going to do my family tree. And I am here to tell you that is just as addicting as chocolate or Coke. I have enjoyed it very much. I went to a lot of classes. I was living in Iowa at the time. I've moved several times since then. I was living in Iowa at the time. They had a really good genealogical society. The internet was just starting to carry a lot of stuff like Ancestry, and Ancestry didn't have a lot on it at the time. So they had classes on how do you get your research done remotely. And the interesting thing I found about that was that they said you need to know how to use people as your readers. A lot of the same things that some of us from my generation had known because the way to get things done was through a live human being reader. I thought that was very interesting. And I joined the Genealogical Society so that I could learn through immersion, if you will, how to do research. What was in the libraries? What were the tools that were there and how to access them? I did that for several years and got to be one of the volunteers that when a new person came into the genealogical library, the state library that was headquartered in Des Moines, they'd say, oh, Peggy, come over here. This person wants to know about, can you get them started? And, you know, I could get them started on the computers. Because there wasn't a lot on them, first of all, and I had memorized the patterns of how to connect into the different programs. But through helping them, I would find out new resources. And that's how I started to really learn about our blind ancestors. Because like I said, I had been collecting stuff from the early 1980s, I've been collecting news articles and books and magazine stories and biographies and so on. Once I learned how to be a genealogist, it was kind of fun to then, when I would get blocked on my family, to pick up one of the things that was in my pile and see what I could find on that person. Through that research, I've been able to not only find a lot of documentation about people or newspaper stories about people, but I've been able to interview descendants, and that has been very helpful in crafting some of my stories. It is amazing to me how much there is out there, and it is amazing to me what is not out there. There are blind people that I know existed, that I have some knowledge of, and they don't show up anywhere. Women are difficult to research. American Indians are difficult to research because their names change. So I find that for me, this is a big puzzle. And I gather all these puzzle pieces, and each story is putting together a little corner in my puzzle of blind people. Well, I want to leave a little bit of time for questions, so I'm just going to kind of get into some of the things about California. I know there's a lot of famous blind guys from California, and those are not always the people I touch on. I like to talk about the people who don't always get noticed. We've got a lot of folks from Newell Perry on up who lots of things have been written about. If there's a lot of things written about somebody, I'm not going down that garden path again. I try to find people that I think contributed greatly. I look for what I call successful people, and what I mean by successful is not that they made a lot of money in their lifetime or that they were president of a company, and there's certainly several of them that fit that bill, but what was the everyday person doing? And did they contribute to the community as well? Now, California became a state in 1850, and you think of all that territory between that and the already established states. That's kind of cool. 1860 was when the private school for the blind, it was for the indigent, deaf, dumb, and blind, opened up in 1860, and of course grew into several different programs. In 1907, one of the things that I thought was interesting is that the first woman's club for blind women was formed. It was associated with the women's clubs and was a chapter, but it was for blind women, kind of a segregated chapter, if you will. But it attracted a lot of the blind women in California who were already out there working. Many of them were musicians because that was kind of the profession that women went into in the early days, was music teacher, concert pianist, and so on. However, California's blind women did advance a lot in that you saw more and more of them becoming dictaphone operators, secretaries, and so on. So the first blind person I'm going to tell you about, he is kind of famous. I was introduced to him actually through a John Jakes novel, and I wanted to know if the character was real. And by golly, he was. And that's Christopher Augustine Buckley. He was born in 1847 and died in 1922. Now, Christopher Buckley has a bunch of stuff written about him, and some of it contradicts each other because Christopher Buckley was just that kind of guy. He was, he came out to California with his family when he was a teen. He started in the tavern or saloon business at an early age. Some say he went blind because he drank his own booze. Some say he had an eye condition that lost his vision within several months. Whatever the case is, by the time he was in his 20s, late 20s, he was totally blind. He did marry three times, and he became, through being a saloon owner, a fairly wealthy man. He bought and sold real estate. He became the person where if you wanted a job in San Francisco at City Hall, You wanted to know Christopher Buckley. He was in charge of many of the voting places. If you voted for his party, you could vote in the light on the first floor. If you voted for the opposing party, you cast your ballot upstairs in an attic somewhere. He loaned out money, and if you didn't pay, you might get a broken arm or something. He didn't believe in knocking them off because then you wouldn't pay. But if you wanted a little money and a favor for your kid, well, you went to Buckley, and later on he'd ask you for a favor in return. He owned and invested in a lot of companies, especially in telegraph companies. He bought a lot of land, and when they would find oil on that land, he would sell it at an exorbitant price. So he wasn't the oil baron, but he was the landowner. Never considered himself a really religious man. He did go to church and everything. But when he finally retired from the politics in California, he bought himself a winery, the Ravenwood Winery. And upon his death, he left it to the Catholic Church. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Now, today, Ravenwood, you can go there, and it's a tourist attraction. They have a lot of things at Christmas and so on. I want to tell you about Dorothy Glass. Dorothy Glass was born in 1897, and she died in 1988. Now, she was totally blind by the age of 6. Her parents didn't know what to do with a blind child, but they wanted to be sure she could take care of herself. So they made her do all the same chores on the ranch that her siblings did. She had to clean the house, do the cooking. She had to clean out the barns, gather eggs, all that good stuff. She also climbed trees and rode horseback. At the age of 12, they sent her to the California School for the Blind. And she graduated there in about 1919. She graduated a little older than most of the kids because she started a lot later. Now, while she was at the School for the Blind, she wanted to be a beautician. That's what she said she wanted to do. Well, the school didn't know of any blind beauticians, and they said, well, you know, take these massage classes because blind people really do a lot of good work and make a lot of money at massage. So she did, but still wanted to go on to be a beautician. The school found a cosmetology school that would accept her. Of course, Dorothy had to pay for that because the school wasn't going to pay for that. And Dorothy was all gung-ho to do that. She graduated near the top of her class. When she finally left the School for the Blind, she went to the hospitals and so on to get a job as a massage therapist. Nobody would hire her. She really didn't have enough cosmetology under her belt. So after a while, she took some more cosmetology classes and then opened her own beauty salon near her parents. She got an apartment about 5 blocks from her beauty salon. She did most of the work except coloring and a few things like that. She hired another girl to do that. After a few years, she closed that shop, moved into a bigger place, and had more girls there to work as well because she's doing the books. She was always the one who did the hair, the nails, that kind of thing. The Depression comes around. A lot of beauty shops closed. Hers did not. And in 1934, we know she had at least 7 employees. And at one time before 1945, she had at least 11 employees in her shop. Now, she also took on a position in 1942 as PR fundraiser canvasser for the National Federation of the Blind. She did this for about 3 years. And the job was to go into the unions, talk to them and get them to support our legislation, the legislation that was up in Congress. So she would go and meet with these union officials. She had to raise money because her salary was a percentage of what she would raise as well. When she would get home, she would type up all of the letters to the officials, copy everybody who needed to be copied on them. And then in a few weeks, she'd travel back to San Francisco or wherever it was that she was meeting these people and, again, do follow-up. In 1947, she decided she was done with Cosmopolitan. She was done with her beauty shops, excuse me. And she decided that she was going to open a answering service. Her goal was to have 60 clients in 60 days. She wrote a letter to a friend and on the 60th day and said that she had met her goal. A lot of the contacts she had made with the unions were many of her first clients. She ran that business until 1974 when she decided to retire. And, you know, by this time, she's already about 77 years old. Well, not quite. Yeah, about 77 years old. So she retires, and she said her goal was to read all the books that she had missed when she was working full-time. Another interesting gentleman from California who has some to do with the laws regarding tenant workers is a man by the name of Charles Snow. Charles was born in 1877. He died in 1967. As a young man, he and his family traveled around the Western Seaboard, up into Canada. They were miners, most of them, drove in a covered wagon. He and his brother went mining in Canada. They went mining in South America. He and his brother became big shots in the mining company. However, he came back to California, and about 1917, he was blinded in a blast that he had only been working at the company for 11 days. And had he been working there for 15 days, they would have provided him with some medical insurance. Well, the family was broke by 1918. They didn't have any money. They had a daughter who was about 18. He decided he needed to do something. His brother told him, well, you've always been a good storyteller and a really great liar, so why don't you write a book? Well, he started to do that because the only skill he had as a blind guy at that time was typing. So he would sit outside and he would type all day. And then later on, maybe his wife or his daughter would review what he had typed. Now, you know, this is before we had spell check, whiteout, all that good stuff. When he learned to type in the mining companies, you had to type correct the first time because paper was valuable. So he was a very accurate typer. But typing these stories, these short stories, and they were usually Westerns, he would submit them to magazines, got a few published, but not a lot. So he decided he was going to run for judge in the county, and he did. The job paid $100 a month, and they were supposed to hire a reader for him, but that didn't happen. So his readers actually came out of his paycheck. He also had become a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and the Sacramento Bee. They were usually little stories about things that were going on near Sacramento because that's where he was living at the time. He would send them up to the Sacramento Bee, and Sometimes they were accepted, sometimes he wasn't. He wasn't on the staff. So therefore, if the article printed, he got some money. But after a few years, he actually started to get articles that were paying. He started to write several Western books. Many of them, actually, in his lifetime, what did he write? He wrote over 460 novels. However, only about 75 of them were actually, 35 of them were actually printed in the United States. They were big in Europe. The army picked up many of his books and printed them for the servicemen. He was honorary president of the Western Writers Association. His wife died in the 1930s. He bought a nice large house a couple of blocks from his daughter, who became his reader secretary. He also hired other secretaries as well, because he was turning out books sometimes within a couple of weeks and getting them ready for the publisher. When he died, he was in the middle of one of his books. We're going to skip ahead to Glenn Hurlburt. I found Glenn fun to research. Glenn was born in 1909 and died in 1961. He came from a family that was not stable. His mother had mental illness, sometimes was in a hospital. His father worked on several different jobs. One of them was being sheriff, and he was gone a lot. Him and his brother, Glenn and his brother, went into foster homes from time to time. When he was a kid, he was blinded in an arrow accident. The arrow went into one of his eyes, and then later on, the second eye followed, which, you know, usually happens. He didn't get any blindness training at all. He didn't go to a school for the blind. He was in Oregon at the time. He graduated from an Oregon high school. By this time, he was already earning part of his living, playing in orchestras and writing music. In the 1930s, he went to California, and he played as a radio station musician, played piano or other instruments from time to time. He got a permanent gig on KSFO radio with his own show. Now, back then, you could work this radio station in the morning, that radio station at noon, and another radio station in the afternoon, and maybe a fourth one at night. And he did a lot of that. He was someone who also worked in an advertising company. In fact, he wrote these jingles that had subliminal messaging in them, and supposedly was the first person to do that subliminal messaging. And the company, the public relations company, would let him tell what the secret was, but he was very proud of it. Now, in the 1940s, the city of San Francisco, if you can imagine, decided that they were going to get rid of their streetcar system. Well, people were all in an uproar about that. That just was a terrible thing. Now, at the a little before this all really broke free, he and a friend established Golden Gate Record Company. And to launch their business, their first record was the Cable Car Concerto. Glenn wrote the music and the words, and it was that sold over like several hundred thousand copies within its first few months. And by the way, it is available on YouTube. If you look for Cable Car Concerto and then Glenn Hurlburt, it'll come up. Now, Glenn was also somebody who he worked with PRs with some of the stores. He did the Christmas record for the store, had the doll that went with the Christmas record, promoted that as well. Radio started to stop having live music. He still had his own show until he died in 1961. But that's when he started contracting with other PR firms for writing commercials, and that's where most of his money came from at that time. We're going to skip ahead a little bit further and talk about Clorinda Manger. Now, Clorinda was born in 1896, died in 1976. She graduated from the School for the Blind in 1913. She was active in several of the clubs and so on in school, loved to write stories. She took typing at school, but then also, after she graduated, learned how to use a dictaphone. By the 1920s, she was working as a dictaphone operator for a newspaper. She also worked as secretary or dictaphone operators for several newspapers, a college campus, law firm, and so on. She worked through the Depression, and then in about 1947 or so, she decided she had enough of being a secretary, and she became a vendor. And I realized I forgot to tell you why I said Charles Snow was so important to the transient workers. And that's because his case, his lawsuit that he brought against the mining companies, was all over the papers. And laws were submitted and finally passed that said that if you had been working there for a period of time, 2 weeks, that you would, the company would need to provide at least some medical for any injuries caused on the job. Now, I'm going to turn this over to you folks, and do you have any questions that you would like to ask?
All right. You do have one hand raised on Zoom. I don't know. Do you guys want to do email first or Zoom?
I think we'll do the Zoom first.
Okay. All right. So the hand is going to be Robert Acosta. You can go ahead, Robert.
Oh, my goodness. Peggy, you're wonderful. I'm on her email list.
Yeah.
Enjoy her thoroughly. And this is why I'm at the convention. I'm going to tell my sins. I said, she's on the program. I want to hear it. A couple of points. I know there's people who want to ask questions. Chris Buckley, I had the privilege of teaching a little California history at Chatsworth High School. He also, Peggy, you probably know, is famous for shaking your hand and telling the other guy who he was. He'd walk around and he'd shake your hand and say, whatever, Joe Smith or whatever. Yes, he was he's the answer to Honey Fitz in Boston. He controlled politics, an amazing guy.
Yes, he did. And he also had really good hearing, and yes, he would pretend not to, you know, he wouldn't face people in his bar, and he picked up a lot of gossip that he used for and against others.
Well, I'm sure. One more point. You might think of Ernie Crawley, assemblyman who helped the blind, yeah, and the Federation. I hope maybe he's written about too much, but he was great. And another guy that I didn't know about, I do now, was Don Wilkinson. Don Wilkinson, from a judge from Eureka, who the opponent said he's blind, he can't be a judge. And he won. Yeah. Don won. And I got to know him as we went along. Thank you. I'll let others ask, but you're wonderful. And thank you for coming to this convention. My best to Curtis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Yeah. And I think that Dorothy Glass is in our Hall of Fame, I believe. I was looking at our website the other day and happened to see that name. So any other hands raised?
Yes, you have two more.
Okay,
next is going to be Andy Bracco.
Yes, I had the privilege of meeting and getting to know Dorothy Glass. This was at the spring 1973 convention of our state organization, which had a different name at that time, but she was 76 years old at that time, which is my age currently. And I have to tell you, she had a lot more energy than I would on my best day. she still was doing her telephone answering service. She was talking about, yeah, she was talking about retiring, but she was the legislative bulldog of that organization. Her and Kathy Skivers were the Regina and Jeff of that era. And Dorothy basically trained Kathy on, you know, how to advocate with legislators. She knew all the big power brokers in Sacramento and in other areas too, in San Francisco, whatnot. And the thing I always remember about Dorothy is that she was the door prize lady at conventions. You know, when it came time to give a door prize, they would say, okay, Dorothy, you know, do your thing. But, you know, it's really neat to hear presentations about people and realize that you met and you knew these people.
And Dorothy was, I mean, she was a very nice looking woman, blonde hair. She always was made up well. And when she would go into some of these union offices, you know, they're mostly men, she took no guff, and they respected her for it because she was very nice, very sweet, very professional, and very firm.
Okay, thank you, Andy, for that. And who's next?
Next is going to be Charlene.
Yes, it would be fun to find the names that will go with this story, but there was a point in San Diego County you could literally have blind justice. We had a blind judge, a blind district attorney, and several blind lawyers.
I might figure that out if I spend a little time on that, because my California file has lots of people in it.
I will tell you, the judge was a Superior Court judge, and I can't remember his name now.
Yeah,
and the other guy does.
I can't say I've focused my attention on the justices in Montana, because there was at one time four blind judges in one county.
But anyway, I thought that was interesting and would be fun to find out who all they were.
Yeah, I might just focus on that.
The DA may have been from the city of Chula Vista. He's either that or San Diego.
All right. Well, thank you, Charlene.
All right, you have two more hands. I don't know how much time, or do you want?
You say we do have more hands?
Yes, yes.
Well, go ahead. We got time.
All right, Dan, you are allowed. You can go ahead. He lowered his hand, so one moment. And the last hand is area code 925, ending in 788. Second.
Earl, I believe.
This is a little off topic, but one of my favorite passages from the 70s was Alice's Restaurant Massacre, which also entertained a a blind judge who really devastated the officer who had taken the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures.
I wrote about him in one of my emails that I sent out. Yeah, because I wondered myself, is that, you know, how real was that song? And that song is an actual true story. And the blind judge walked in with his dog guide and just upset everybody's apple cart. It was fun. Which reminds me, Yes, sir. I was just going to say, I do have a monthly email, and if you want to sign up for it, please just shoot me an email at theblindhistorylady, that's all one word, theblindhistorylady@gmail.com, and you can get on my email list.
Yeah. That's great. Wow, good. We appreciate that contact. Were there any other hands raised? We're getting probably time for one more question. If there's no hands raised, there might be an email. I'll ask Steve if that's the case.
I'm not seeing any emails, so...
okay, yeah. All right. So were there any other hands raised, or was Earl the last?
Let me see. One second. Oh, Dan, just a moment.
Oh, hi. Peggy, I think, is your name.
Yeah.
I had a great conversation with you about a month ago, Dan Kaiser, and We were talking about Newell Perry, who happens to be the first president of the California Council of the Blind, and I was really going on and on to you about Proposition 19 and 1923. Can you tell us a little bit about how significant that proposition was and how it could have affected the beginning of Social Security as we know it?
Refresh my memory on Proposition 19.
Okay, it gave a pension to gave an income to blind, needy blind in California.
Yeah, and that caused a stir across the country. Actually, it did.
Passed by 2/3 too.
In fact, there's references to that in the minutes of the Colorado's organization, which was called the United Workers for the Blind. Through some correspondence. It's interesting for me to note how blind people were in touch with each other all across the country, because California had connections with Colorado. And I think part of that was because some of the kids from the Colorado School for the Blind went out west. Yeah. But the pension bills, they were varied across the country, but providing a monthly income for people that was statewide was something that was not, it wasn't approved of by some parts of the blind community. Other parts wanted it very much. Blind people, of course, did. But it was thought that if they did that, blind people would get lazy and not go to work. And it was the fact that these pension bills were coming up, Social Security came around in the 1930s, but these pension bills were the seeds for providing a Social Security option and a disability option for blind people across
the country. Peggy, I want to really thank you for being able to give us these wonderful stories. And it's a reminder that blind people, there's so many things we can do and a lot of things you wouldn't expect us to be able to do, and we do it. So thanks for coming, and take care of that darn cold.
No kidding.
Could you repeat the email list one more time?
I would be glad to. It is theblindhistorylady@gmail.com.
Thank you.
So all one word, theblindhistorylady.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Peggy.
Do we have any other emails? Anything in emails before we move on from Peggy?
No emails, no.
Good. Just wanted to just give
that. No, I figure, Steve, if we get an email, you'll notify us.
Definitely.
I think that's the best way to do it. Guess what? Door prize time. Is Lisa on the line?
She is.
Okay.
We're going to do $25 parking card from the Bayview chapter. And the winner is Ralph Black. Congratulations, Ralph.
All right, Ralph. Congratulations indeed. All right, now I think we're moving on now to the AI presentation. Am I right?
We are.
Yes, okay, very good. So let me go ahead and turn it over to Gabe. Let him
tell us a little. Actually, you're
turning
it over to me.
Oh, you're the moderator.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, go ahead and take it away.
You scared me for a second, Ralph.
That was a little scary, yes.
Yeah, that was.
Anyway, welcome. Welcome, everybody. I hope that you all have enjoyed the presentations today thus far. So AI, a little daunting for some, exciting for others, and just very, it's a new frontier in the way we do things, technological, techno, technologically, if I can speak. And so I thought, you know, when Sarah and I were talking at a back meeting in Sacramento a few months ago, we thought how good it would be to have a session on this, because one of our presenters is super passionate about this subject. So I want to introduce our panel. We have Eli Andres, who is an adaptive technology specialist at Resource Center, Resource for Independence, Central Valley. We have someone who we all know very well, Dave Griffith, assistive technology instructor at the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco. And we have somebody who's no stranger to us all, Joe Xavier from Department of Rehabilitation. And we're going to be talking about AI from an employment perspective, as well as from an educational perspective, and just AI in an everyday type setting situation. So I think what I'd like to do is start with Joe and, you know, let's hear his perspective. And it's going to be a very informal conversation. Your participation is going to be needed as well. So we will have time for Q&A for these three gentlemen. And so definitely feel free to ask whatever strikes, you know, at the moment. So Joe, go ahead and take it away.
So Gabe, thank you.
And it's Guillermo.
Guillermo, sorry. So first, just want to say hello to everyone. And just to make sure that there's no misunderstandings, I am formerly the director for the Department of Rehabilitation. And so when I was asked to come here by originally Sarah and Guillermo, you know, obviously this is something that was very much on my mind in that role. Obviously something I still have lots of passion about, but certainly not here today per se as the representative of the department, given that I have retired effective the end of last year. Let me share with you a little bit about what my mindset is when I think about artificial intelligence, and then what are the things when it comes to employment and the workplace that were and remain very much in my mind. First, my mindset. I think a lot about past technological milestones and what transpired during those periods of time, including how individuals with disabilities were accounted for. And as we all know, quite often, it was an afterthought. Oh, yeah, we need to. Oh, yeah, we will. And not we're thinking about it and doing it on the front end. I also think about, particularly back in the 80s and 90s with the onset of personal computers, the fear was that personal computers would replace people. And I think it's safe to say that while personal computers may not have replaced people, people who use personal computers have certainly replaced individuals who would not or do not use personal computers. I also think it's important to keep in mind, and something that I was always very cognizant of, that the exponential growth around artificial intelligence makes what we know today obsolete just in a matter of weeks and a few months. So what we know today, don't worry about it. It is changing and changing very rapidly. I think it's essential the principles and values around the use and the application of artificial technology be centered on people. I think it's important to keep in mind that it will be as pervasive as digital technology. So anywhere where digital technology exists today, AI is or will be there. And I think it's important that AI account for accessibility and the disability rights of individuals with disabilities. So let me talk a little bit about this from the employment perspective. So first, it's important to recognize that transformative artificial intelligence, AI, will only be effective and will only be transformative if and when leadership embraces it, adopts it, and acts on it. One of the pillars that is very much in my mind around AI is reasonable accommodations for individuals in the workplace. It applies to virtually all disabilities and certainly blind and visually impaired. It expands the effectiveness of assistive technologies for individuals with disabilities. It provides opportunities for solutions for accommodations for individuals with disabilities we're not even thinking of today. And of course, it provides the opportunity to increase both personal and professional independence for the individual in the workplace, in the everyday community. So when I think about AI from the workforce perspective, it enables the ability to enhance and maximize staff's performance both in public sector and in private sector amongst all of our service providers as an example of the private sector. So if I think about how that can come to play as a workforce multiplier, I often would think about that if we could save 2 hours a day from each of the 2,000 employees workforce, it would generate the equivalent of 500 positions of capacity across the organization. And that is particularly important in the light of the fact that, you know, the number of positions continue to be reduced because of the budget implications that we have in the state, both at the federal and at the state level. I think it's essential that staff need to be able to effectively engage and understand how to use AI in order to maximize it as part of the workforce, but more importantly, to engage with the individuals that come to the department and come to all of the organizations for services. One of the concerns that I long held is that individuals in the workforce who are either unwilling or unable to effectively adapt and engage with AI will exit the workforce prematurely and find the need to return to their workforce. And then the very reason they exited that barrier now becomes a much larger barrier when they try to get back into the workforce. So finally, let me touch on individuals who are coming to our programs and services. And when I say ours, I'm not talking about just the Department of Rehabilitation. I'm talking about all providers, right? Individuals that come to us for services, AI is a tool to help that individual become ready for employment. You can use it as mock interviews. You can use it in research for particular job functions and particular duties that a job may entail. You can use it to prepare your applications and your cover letters and the things that you would otherwise use for the job. But it's also essential because that individual is more than likely going to have in their first job the need to effectively engage as part of their job with artificial intelligence. And so in order for them to be competitive, they need to know that going in, not after the fact. Think about it in the same way that you think about a PC. Imagine somebody applying for a job that required computing skills, and they get there and they don't have any computing skills. One, how effective will they be, or how competitive will they be in the interview process? And two, how will they actually be able to perform the functions of the job if they don't have that? The other thing that very much was on my mind and continues to be on my mind is for the individual who's either unwilling or unable to effectively adapt and engage with AI, what becomes of their employment options? That to me is a severe restriction on what they will actually have an opportunity to go to work on. So finally, I would say that AI applies to much more than employment. It applies to healthcare. It applies to education. It applies to community living, just as a couple of examples. I will stop my comments there and send it back to Guillermo to turn it over to others and get into the conversation.
So I do have a question for you before we turn it over to others. So you mentioned this workforce multiplier, and it's a I like that concept a lot because, yes, even with the stuff that we've done with CCB in getting our resolutions through some of the AI process and even audio stuff, it's just saved us so much time. But I'm kind of curious to know what type of stuff that you personally have done personally with AI to sort of streamline the efficacy of the department.
Yeah, so I'm going to be careful,
I know it's a question that probably you can't disclose much of, but I'm just like,
yeah,
just kind of curious to see how you dealt with that stuff personally.
Yeah, in part because I'm retired, so I want to, with all due respect to present leadership, it's their voice that you want to hear and exactly how they're going to move forward. What I will tell you is what was going through my mind as we've been engaging in this conversation for the last 18, 12 months or so around AI. When I talk about in the workplace, I think about what a counselor might be doing in terms of some local regional labor market information gathering to be more specific and more nuanced about what they were offering their consumers. I would think about how you can use it to search governance and compile very quickly what might be applicable to the decision you have at hand. I would think about it in the context of individuals whose English might be a second language, which is something we absolutely valued, and how that would otherwise be enhanced by having AI to help improve the presentation of the written materials. So those are just a couple of examples. I mean, there's so much that we can look at in terms of how it might be used to free up time. And I think what's important when you think about freeing up time, we think about it like you're going to free up these huge blocks of times. From some individuals, it might be, 4 hours. From others, it might be 1 hour. I think you got to think about it more globally and start freeing up 5, 10 minutes here, 20 over there, 15 over here, and then restructure that time to leverage that capacity to provide the services that, we're delivering. And again, I really emphasize, this is not just for the public sector. This is very much across the workforce, which includes all of our service providers, all of our partners across the state.
Thank you for that. Gabe, let's go with you.
Okay. First of all, hello, everybody. And I want to thank Guillermo and the convention planning folks for this invitation. It's kind of exciting to be able to present in or speak to y'all in a completely different way than I have for a long time. So thank you for that. When I think of AI in the workforce, I think that's a lot of stuff that Joe talked about of, I know people that have used things like ChatGPT to help them prepare at least a first draft of a cover letter. If you do that, obviously it's going to be able to prepare the letter, but then you're going to have to kind of add some stuff in and maybe change a couple of things, but that can help you really generate that base to go off of. You can do it for reports. I know computers have different programs in them now that can generate your reports. But also, I think about all the different apps on our phones that can be used for not just productivity, but getting ready or our household usages. That's a big part of what I do is not only teaching people how to use their devices, but touching on a lot of these different apps. We have things like Seeing AI that has the name AI right in it. We have Be My Eyes with Be My AI right in it. and just all these different things. Joe talked about language translation, and there are several different language translation apps out there. I've gotten into Uber rides that the driver spoke nothing but Chinese, but through Google Translate, he and I had a great conversation during that ride. He told me all about his dad who's still in China and is losing his sight. And just, you know, not too many years ago, we probably never would have been able to have that. So AI brings so much, not just to our work lives, but to all aspects of our lives. And I keep telling people that when I think of all the stuff that AI brings to us that we didn't have 40 years ago, 20 years ago, or even 5 years ago, it's pretty amazing and pretty exciting. And when we think about where the future of it's going, I feel like we need to be a little cautious, but it can be very exciting. I keep telling people that as a human, I'm a little bit scared about AI. I won't lie to y'all. But as a blind person, it is so exciting of all the different things it can do for us. And I look forward to getting into this discussion a little bit further. So I know that was hopefully fairly quick, but I'll pass it back to you, Guillermo, to move on.
Let's hear from Eli's perspective.
Hi, everyone. I'm Eli Andres from Resource for Independence Central Valley. And for AI, everybody first might think of visual description in the blind community, how we can use it to see the world around us. Taking a picture, maybe an environment that we once were able to and now be able to be described to us. AI could also be a use for education in a way of training yourself. Whether you're trying to learn a difficult concept, you can ask the AI to be your teacher in a geometry setting or a biology, but whatever topic it may be, it could be your teaching, a teacher for a day. It could also be the translation, like what Joe and Gabe has touched upon. It could translate from the language you might be using to a different language to provide multiple language for documents and such. AI can also be used in the daily use when you are trying to come up with ideas for yourself. Maybe you're thinking about dinner and you have no clue what to make. Now with AI, one can take a picture of what they got from their fridge and get feedback from AI to see what can they make up for dinner that night. So AI is quite advancing, and it's being a lot helpful to us, an aid to us, and hopefully not a replacement for a lot of things we do.
Great. So what is one of the things that you say has made you, because Eli, you mentioned feeding it prompts as far as like getting concepts. So what advice would you have as far as getting the most successful results, or as I like to call them, feedback from the answers that you get from the AI? What have you done that's been helpful for you?
First off, it's mostly when you get your feedback from the AI response, going back and being a bit more detailed. Perhaps maybe your first round of asking your question, it didn't come back with a right answer. Maybe you put a scatter of foods and it thought it was an entirely different set of objects. Maybe it thought you were doing some knitting or something. It might thought the tomato was a clown's nose for some reason. And maybe you got to go back to it and tell it that that red object was a tomato. And so going back to the AI and helping it by providing feedback to it can help you out getting a better results from AI.
Hey, Guillermo, can I add to that?
Sure.
So I think this past fall, I was up in Seattle at a conference, and we had somebody there that you could tell had been living AI for decades. And one of the things that he impressed upon the audience is that when you're getting, pardon the expression, when you're getting garbage out of your query of AI, the idea is not to stop querying the AI, but change your query that you're asking of AI. Let me give you an example. A few weeks ago, my grandson and my daughter and my wife and I were having dinner, and something came up, and we were going to ask the smart speaker the question. I posed the question. It totally said, I don't know what you're saying. My daughter posed the question. It barely did a little bit better. And my eight-year-old grandson posed the question, was totally different than what either one of us had said, and it nailed it. It gave exactly the answer that we were looking for. And I think just use that thinking of, if you're not getting the result you're looking for, it's probably because you need to think about the question in a different way. And frankly, there's lots of benefit asking multiple questions from different frameworks to, and I don't want to say validate, but to get a good sense of what it's generating and its applicability to the issue at hand.
All right, that sounds really good. And Gabe, how about you?
Can you repeat this question?
So what have you found to be helpful as far as getting good results from your interactions with AI?
The others have said just, you know, I'm fond of reminding my colleagues that artificial intelligence is no match for natural stupidity. So, you know, it can be very helpful, but I think it was Eli that was talking about like taking a picture of it and it's saying a tomato, and you have to be like, no, this is a clown's nose. You know, you have to kind of be able to have an idea of what the thing's telling you and know when it's totally off versus maybe just a little bit off, versus maybe completely accurate. So it's a balance of using our own brains, but also using whatever particular app it is to be able to get the information you want or to be able to interpret what it's telling you. If you're using something like ChatGPT to either generate something or ask it something, you have to be a little bit careful about, or I shouldn't say careful. It's a learning process, I'd say, about learning what information to give it, put into it. Because most of the time, it's going to try to spit out whatever it thinks you're asking, given the prompt it's given. So that's just kind of an experimental learning how to prompt it for the information you want. But if it's taking a picture, then, as I was saying, you have to just be able to interpret. And again, I guess that's a learning process, too. You have to interpret what it's telling you. You know, I know when I've experimented with things like Be My AI, it's awesome because you can take a picture out a window and learn things about what's out your window, maybe at home or maybe in your office, that you never knew. Or if I've done demonstrations where I took a picture of one of our counters at work, and I described it as, this is a counter with several computers on it. There's monitors and keyboards and a Coke can and cables all over the place. And you're going, wait, a Coke can? That doesn't belong here. So, you know, it's just funny, the stuff that, as somebody who can't see that scene that you're taking a picture of, that sometimes you hear things totally unexpected. And it was totally accurate in that instance, but it was just a bit of a shock of going, wait, this doesn't belong here. And then went and started feeling along the counter and found this Coke can that somebody had left there. You know, so again, it was quite shocking, but it was very helpful at the same time to be able to clean up that area.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can be fun. It can be experiment. I always like to say that if you're going to start experimenting with this, you know, for those of you out there that may have never used this stuff, if you're going to take the pictures, and I'd be curious to hear what Eli and Joe think about this stuff, but if you're going to take pictures, try to do it maybe in an environment that you know first, because that can help if you have that baseline of you're taking a picture maybe of your desk at home or your living room or something, areas that you know and you know what's there, then that can help to build that baseline of how it's working when you go and use it out in the world in an area that you're not familiar with to try to get that info.
That's true. And so, given the makeup of the organization, I think about how resistant we are to change, and how, we're so stuck in what's comfortable, So my question to the three of you is, what advice would you give someone that is in that mindset, whether it be maybe somebody younger who's not used to technology, or even a senior who just has a hard time with this? I mean, how would you, what advice would you give to sort of get your feet wet into this big, daunting world of AI, which is sometimes so unreliable and just unpredictable?
Yeah, I'll be glad to kick this off. So, I think first you have to recognize, just call out what you're saying, which there is a generational aspect to this, and that it's okay. But I think when you put that on the table, there are some of us who are no longer in the workplace, and so maybe using it for work is not going to necessarily be what you focus on. But think about how you might use it for everyday things around the house. So, for example, I use the smart speaker for timers. I use the smart speaker just for listening to the radio, and that all has AI built into it. I mean, a lot of that already has AI built
Yeah,
into
we're
it.
already using it, not even realizing it sometimes.
Exactly.
So.
So one of the things, for example, is we go do a lot of Google search. Well, when you go do Google search, it gives you a lot of resources that you then got to go read. If you use AI to do that search, it's capturing and summarizing the resources from all that. And I'm going to venture a guess that most everybody on here is using JAWS. And the current version of JAWS has a major AI built into it, not only for picture smart, like somebody's been mentioned. But think about, I don't quite remember how to do this in JAWS. You could just bring up your FS Companion and type in what you want to do. And without having to read the manual or read cheat sheets or all, it'll give you a step-by-step very succinctly and very effectively. So find those individual uses and let it grow.
Eli?
One of the best ways I was able to get someone that was an older generation into AI is when I first got her using the Meta Ray-Ban glasses. When she told me her experience of using it when she was at her parent-teacher conference, she was able to participate during the time where they're handing out leaflets, pamphlets, and she was able to capture the information that was given to her and take part in the parent-teacher conference. And she was blown away how AI was able to help her being in the moment instead of being like a second class, I guess, getting information later. But it really helped her a lot.
So how about we take some questions from the audience and see if there's anything out there? Any questions for this group of people?
Yes, you do have two hands raised. So Dan, you are going to be up.
Congratulations, Joe, for your retirement. That's awesome. And Joe, you are one of the first people I ever met that had a computer in his office that was using it with speech. So Joe goes back a long ways with technology, and you can certainly tell today. I wanted to add something that I don't know. I know a lot of the techies know this, but we all know who Ray Kurzweil is. And Ray is the father of AI. And Joe was talking about exponential growth in AI. And he's the dude that came up with the whole theory behind that and how fast it's growing and all that kind of stuff. So I had an opportunity to meet with Ray Kurzweil back in the 70s. When I did a interview with him on Metro Media, on the Metro Media Network, and that aired all over the country. I was able to pay my rent that month, which was nice. So AI helped me pay my rent. The one thing I did want to add to what everybody is saying is a cautionary note on GPT. I use Gemini too, and I really like it. I anytime I ask any kind of question, no matter how stupid, it gives me the right answer. I would say 99.995% of the time. But there is, and I'm writing a book, and when I'm doing my research for the book, I was looking for the very first school for the blind, and it listed, or no, the very first guide dog school. And it listed 1787. No, that's not true. So you really have to check its work if you're going to get serious about, you know, throwing this out in the public, your results out in the public, because it can let you down. So thank you, guys. I think you guys did a really good job presenting it. And I think that there's also exponential growth in the user of AI. The more you work with it, it remembers. Some AIs actually remember what you've typed in and correlates that with your particular knowledge. And that's how good the AI is getting. So thank you.
Do we have any email?
Cameron, can I jump in here real quick?
Sure.
Dan, thank you for those comments. And I just want to specifically thank you for your cautionary comment there. That kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, if you're going to be using AI for pictures or for finding out what's around you, just knowing your stuff and being able to not necessarily have AI verify it, but to build on that. So if you know, you know, roughly when a certain date of something was, and it gives you an answer that's, you know, a century and a half off, you know, maybe go back again. So thank you for that. And I agree, just, you know, use a little bit of your own common sense and your own natural intelligence to question. If something doesn't sound right on a response, it might not be.
Eli, do you have anything to add to this?
No, but Gabe touched it really well that we all should do a due diligence of what was presented to us from AI and checking the facts if that was correct or not, or just providing another different kind of question if you did not get the right response.
It's all in phrasing. And I was mm-hmm. talking to a friend yesterday, and he was mentioning that what he does is say something like, pretend I am a bartender and I want to mix up such and such drink. Give me a good recipe. Or pretend I am a scientist and I want to learn more about a particular subject. So it's getting it into that mindset. And so that's why I had asked the question about, you know, phrasing and whatnot. So any other questions?
Yes, Bob Acosta, you can go ahead.
Well, it may have been answered, but as an old retired school teacher in the public schools, I said that part. I won't say it again. I flirt with Leah, by the way, on LI every night. Tell her good night. She answers. She's a robot. But these kids are tricky enough. Number one, what if I used to give an assignment on the Battle of Gettysburg and a kid just gets AI and rattles it off? How do you teach him to think and research himself rather than the words? I used to catch some copying because they use big words, and I'd bring them in and say, okay, tell me what circa 1950 means. Well, I don't know. Well, you used it. That's the way I did it. But how do you have any advice for teachers and other professors that get these AI essays or term projects? Thank you.
Yeah.
I've got some answers.
Yeah, go ahead, Gabe. Go ahead.
So I've seen several things on this, Bob. One is I've seen teachers that are now telling their students they have to write things with, you know, out longhand by pen instead of using their computers, and they have to do them in class now. Mm-hmm. Also, in addition to that is there are programs that teachers can use to run an essay or run an assignment through that will actually scan it and tell them what percentage of AI that paper is. So if somebody does, you know, runs it through and says, oh, this paper is 92% AI generated, then, you know, that gives them a pretty good idea that they didn't hardly do any work on it. But if it were to come back maybe and say it's 13% AI generated, then maybe that tells that teacher that, okay, they used this, you know, maybe they used AI to get an outline and get started. So I think it all depends on that teacher, how much AI they are willing to allow, but also there are those tools that allow them to verify it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gabe. That really helps. So I'll pass it on to my friends.
So let me add a little bit to that, Bob. I think I'm going to take a little bit bigger than just the teacher and the assignment in the classroom. There's lots of conversation going on about, well, this means that people won't do X or they're cheating or they're doing something else. Mm-hmm. So let's just take that on for a second. First, as somebody that did a heck of a lot of hiring, I would invite people to use AI to generate whatever they wanted to generate to apply for the job. Do so at your risk. When you're sitting in front of me for the interview and you can't speak to what's on your resume, mm-hmm. let that speak for itself. The other thing is, this isn't new, right? I mean, if somebody is going to have somebody else do their resume, mm-hmm. or somebody's going to have somebody else do their assignment, or somebody, you know, all those types of things have been around for a very long time. There's not too much new in human behavior when it comes to that. And it's also, let's look at how technology and how society has to both adapt and evolve for what's at hand. There was a point in time that using a calculator was just like creating a mortal sin. Because you would be dumb and you couldn't do this and that and the other. And today, think about how frequently we use a calculator, including on every damn phone, right? Are people cheating because they use Word to spell check or to get their grammar correctly? So there will be that period of adjustment between what technology enables us to do and how we as humans embrace the use of that technology, right? And I mean, we can go on. How do you apply that in, for example, autonomous driving or in the medical community, mm-hmm. right? So there's just so many types of things there. But I want to lift up the idea that human behavior about misrepresenting or doing something, there's nothing new about that, right? AI is just going to be another tool that they can use. But at the end of the day, there will be ways to address that. And again, I never was bothered by somebody that submitted a resume they couldn't defend when they were having a conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joe. And I just want to do a time check with Rob.
Yes, it's approaching 2:30. I don't think we have any emails, or I think Steve would have responded. So I think
thank you guys for the questions. And I just want to thank Gabe and Eli and Joe for joining us for this really good interactive discussion. And this is just the beginning of a wider range discussion that if people want it, we can definitely get with our technology people. And maybe host some type of an event like this. So I want to thank you guys for your participation. Good discussion.
Thank
All
you.
right,
And
very good.
I guess I would just end by saying, if you're hearing about this stuff for the first time, feel free to reach out. I don't know about the other guys, but I'm willing to talk to people about it. And I'm sure we all know somebody there that has experience, and probably all of us even know people that have more experience than we do. So just reach out to somebody and don't be afraid to ask questions.
All right. Well, let's, before we get to our next panel, which we're running slightly behind schedule, I hope that's going to be okay. But let's go ahead and do another door prize, and then we'll do.
I'm sorry, before we do anything, can we have Leslie Tom raise her hand, and can she be brought up to the side of the stage, please?
Yep, I'm getting it. Just a second. I was giving Lisa permission, and I'm getting Leslie.
Thank you very much. All right, go ahead, Rob.
All right, so we'll start with the door prize, then we'll do one of the chapter of the year presentations, recordings.
Okay, thank you, Rob. We're going to do a $25 Starbucks card from Contra Costa chapter. And the winner is Lynette Kersey. Congratulations, hey. Lynette.
A member of the SBCB chapter at one time, and now a member of Kahlua. So very good. All right, Larry, you ready to play us a chapter of the year recording?
I am.
Great.
It's IDC.
Inclusive okay. Diversity of California, or IDC, is now 4 years old. We believe a rising tide lifts all boats. Our focus is to lift up the concerns of Black, Indigenous, Hispanic, Asian, Pacific Islanders, and other marginalized communities. But our programs are for everyone. We have held listening sessions on hate crimes, aggregate data's importance to a nonprofit, legal cases affecting people who are blind or have low vision and are incarcerated or face reproductive health discrimination, the history of deportation and people with disabilities, and fun games like Who Am I Anyway? Or Name That Tune. We have held seminars on Law 504 and the fight for disability rights and on self-care and our mental health in turbulent times. We have something to help everybody while reaching out to communities who often are unaware of the resources available for people who are blind or have low vision living in California. We honor diversity while promoting unity.
Okay, thank you, Regina, for that recording. And we'll move into our next panel now, and it's called Touching the Court, a Haptic Experience. We've got Bree Fraser and Jeff Tom and Leslie Tom are going to do the presentation. So why don't you go ahead and let's get that started.
Wonderful. Hi, everyone. My name is Bree Fraser. I'm calling in from Seattle, Washington, to speak today about One Court. And Leslie, I'm honored to share the stage with Jeff and Leslie. Leslie, did you want to introduce yourself as well? I'm sure maybe you don't need introduction, but.
No, actually, I don't. But I'm Leslie Tom, and I'm from Sacramento.
Wonderful. So I first met Leslie because she's a current season ticket holder at the Sacramento Kings, which is one of the NBA basketball teams that One Court partnered with this year. So I'm really excited to leverage Leslie's lived experience of using One Court. So Leslie, feel free to jump in as we go to share your perspective as well.
Okay.
Wonderful. So first I'll start with a description of what One Court is. So at One Court, we are creating a tactile sports broadcast that makes live sports more accessible to fans with visual disabilities. And so we're particularly building this technology with the blind and low vision community. And so we have created a tactile tablet. It's about 13 inches by 7 inches. as it sits on your lap. It's about 2 inches thick. And on the surface of the device, we have over 200 haptic motors. And so what we do is we translate the live gameplay that's happening with sports games, and we translate that through trackable vibrations so fans can follow the game through touch. And so that's a little bit about what we do, but maybe I'll start with describing why the team at One Court started to create this tactile technology. So we heard three main challenges that folks were experiencing when enjoying live sports. And we heard that often live sports was an inaccessible experience because audio broadcasts or the radio can fail to convey detailed information about the play, but also it's often delayed and not in real time. So the first one was that missing key details, things like where the ball and the player positions are. Sometimes sports commentators, as wonderful and excited as they can get, sometimes they're talking about their lunch rather than what's happening on the court or the field. And so there were key details that were missing from the play. The second challenge was that there's often an audio delay. The radio can be delayed anywhere from 30 to 90 seconds if the venue doesn't have an enclosed circuit radio, which luckily Leslie and the Sacramento Kings do, but not every venue has that live radio. And the third is that just generally the in-venue experience can be inaccessible. And so even if folks have interest in going to a live game, many choose not to attend these live events. Leslie, from your perspective, have you felt any of these challenges in the past?
Yes. We used to take a radio to the event, to the games, and then all of a sudden the radio feed wasn't working inside the arena. And that meant we were just kind of sitting there going, well, what's going on? We had no idea unless the announcer said something. Oh, and so they worked on that and got the radio feed to come in through receivers that we borrow at the game. And then when One Court came in, it was a whole nother experience. We basically were able to tell exactly, you know, where the ball was, where it's moving to, what side the team's basket is on that you're looking for, so you can tell the vibrations going that direction. It made things open up so much to me.
Wonderful. Thank you, Leslie. And so as we start to describe, you know, what the device feels like or the experience that it brings, I'll provide a little bit more detail about what the surface of the device is like. So over top those 200 haptic motors that I was describing, we have an interface. It's a thin silicone grippy layer, and we actually customize it for every sport. So the surface of a basketball court is going to feel different because it has different tactile lines than, say, a baseball diamond or a soccer field. And so by layering that tactile map, if you could call it a map of the court, then a fan is able to feel through touch not only the dimensions of the court, but where the play is happening on that court in real time. And Leslie, maybe you could describe what exactly you're feeling. Like, what is tracking the ball feel like on the device? And what is a 2-point versus a 3-point shot feel like on the device?
Yeah, the feeling of it is that when the vibrations are moving around on the display, and you can feel the lines that they have on the device are raised, so that there is the free throw line, the lane where the 3-point shots would be, the basket is also another feeling. It's very small circle at one end. So when the ball is coming to that side, you feel the vibrations and it's rushing. It's going fast, pretty quick. So you follow it and you can tell exactly where the ball is on the court or where it is in relationship to the lines that denote the play. And so you're following it, and it has also a voice component that tells you a few things, and they will tell you when they've actually made the shot, what team, what the score is at any point in time. You can push a button to find out exactly what it is at that moment. But you might just tell them how the feed is actually presented. I mean, with the cameras in the ceiling and how the timeline goes, how it's done.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it was really important to us that not only we could describe what's happening on the court through touch, but we wanted it to be real time. We wanted it to be live. And so what we realized early on in the development of OneCourt was that we didn't actually need to collect this data, this information about what was happening on the court, because the professional leagues were already collecting it. So they, depending on the league, either use cameras in the arenas, or they use chips that might be in the shoulder pads and football, or maybe there's even a chip in the football itself. And these leagues, like the NBA for basketball, are collecting immense amounts of data. It's pretty hard to imagine, but they're tracking 20 points on every player's body. Everything from the angle of their elbow to how fast they're running. And of course, we don't need all of that detailed information. We only need to know where the ball is, where the players are, and what's happening in the play. Are they shooting? Are they dribbling, etc.? And so by building relationships directly with the leagues, we've been able to access this data. And so in our first year of working full-time on this company, because it is a younger company, we started out of the University of Washington a few years ago, we were able to get free access to this data to create a proof of concept. And so we had data from the MLB baseball, from NBA basketball, and from NFL football. And so we were able to prove through a few pilots that this experience really is real time. So the leagues are collecting the data on the court or on the field. We access that data from the internet. So the devices are connected to the internet either through Wi-Fi or a 5G connection technology. And it's under 0.3 of a second. So less than a second delay between what's happening on the court and feeling it on the device, which is pretty incredible.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So fast.
Yeah, it is amazing. It's hard to fathom sometimes. And so I think that's really where the experience goes from good to great, is the whole arena will cheer when, you know, let's say the Kings at Golden One Center in Sacramento make an important shot, and fans can now interpret that for themselves rather than relying on someone else to relay that info and cheer in real time. That's one of my favorite anecdotes to hear from fans is for the first time they feel like they're a part of the game. Rather than just going to an event, they feel a part of the event, which I think is a huge difference.
I would like to say that for me, in using this device several times this year, I felt, you know, and I really do feel part of it. I'm there feeling the vibrations and the play going fast to the other, you know, to the basket. And I'm like, yeah, come on. I feel like I'm part of it. I really do. And I never felt that before. I would listen to it, you know, we heard on the radio feed. But the actual feeling of it happening even ahead of the radio feed, basically, it's been amazing to me. And I get so excited, and I'm feeling the vibrations, and it's going towards our basket. Okay, come on. And, you know, I just, I feel so much a part of the game.
Thank you, Leslie. I'm so glad you're here today to give your anecdotes as we go through today. So we've talked about the technology. We've talked about, you know, the problem that we're trying to solve, the challenges with in-venue. But I think it's also important to note that in-venue is only one way that we're bringing one court to fans. So currently we are working with 5 NBA teams, basketball teams. We started off with the Portland Trailblazers. They were our first launch partner. And then we quickly expanded to the Sacramento Kings, the Phoenix Suns, the Brooklyn Nets, and the LA Clippers. So pretty exciting to have 2 out of 5 of our teams in California. And then we're looking to expand to MLB baseball for this summer. And so there's a lot of discussions happening with MLB teams to see who are going to be our first launch partners. And so by offering the device in stadium, it's been at no cost to fans. So in some cases, we've been able to give away free tickets. In other cases, fans will purchase their own tickets or be a season ticket holder like Leslie. And all a fan needs to do is check the device out from guest services at no cost. And the reason why we wanted to start this way, this business model, is because we're able to have 5 devices, for example, in Sacramento, or 10 devices in Phoenix. And every game, it could technically be a new fan trying one court for the first time. And so for us, we wanted to be able to scale the hardware to a small amount. So we had about 30 devices across the NBA, but reach as many fans as we could. So we had over 200 fans from the blind and low vision community try one court this past basketball season. And so after each of these games, we're collecting feedback. We want to hear from fans what went well, what can we continue to improve? And a great example of that is from fans in Sacramento. We heard, we want more details about the play. So for example, Leslie was describing the audio bites that accompany the haptics. So we'll have short form audio that says things like shot attempt, shot made, foul, or rebound. But fans wanted to know who was shooting and who were they passing to and who just made that shot. Or who got fouled. So things like player information, we've now been able to build into our baseball experience for this summer. So every time a fan tries it, we want to hear their feedback. And then eventually we're going to be scaling to at home. So next year, by 2026, our goal is to have the at home one court experience available. So you can imagine, just like you have a TV doing a visual broadcast or the radio doing an audio broadcast, we want to have one court being that tactile broadcast for sports. And so you could stream any sport, any game from the comfort of your home. So fans could sign up for which leagues that they want to stream on the device. So there would be an upfront cost for the device itself, as well as a league pass for whichever sports that you want to follow that season. So those are the two ways that we're bringing one court to fans. And maybe I can talk a little bit about our collaboration with organizations. So there's been 2 ways that we've really been collaborating. The first way is to spread awareness. This is a new way to be enjoying live sports. And so it's really important for us to get the word out there as much as possible. So we'll often attend events like this. So big thanks to Jeff and Leslie for inviting one court to join. So that more folks can hear about the technology and we can learn more about experiences, current experiences with live sports. It offers an opportunity for us to gather newsletter and waitlist signups, which is really helpful for us because when we look at our waitlist, we look at where people are located across the country. And then those are the sports teams that we look to partner with. So a big reason why we were able to bring one court to 2 teams in California is because we have so much support from the state across, not just in LA, but more broadly. And so that's been really helpful in us going to sports teams and saying, hey, these are all the fans that we have that would love to have one court at your venue and would attend. And so those waitlist signups really help us connect the dots between community and these sports teams. And then eventually that wait list will be the first pool of people that will have access to the at-home device, because we're looking to launch in a little bit of a phased approach. So launching X number of devices every few months. And so folks on that list will get first dibs on those devices. And then the third way is doing community activations. So we love traveling to different parts of the country to demo the One Quart device, because Leslie and I can sit here and describe it as much as we want, but there's nothing that beats actually feeling it for yourself. So we'll attend community events to run demos. When we're able to, we'll invite fans to join us for live activations and games. And then most recently, we've actually started doing watch parties, which has been a lot of fun. So you can imagine you and your friends and family joining us at a local sports bar. We bring One Quart devices, and then we sync them to the TV broadcast at the sports bar, or pub, or restaurant. So sighted fans might be using the TVs in the sports bar, and then blind or low vision fans can be using the One Quart devices to follow along in real time. And so we just recently did a baseball watch party last weekend, and it was a ton of fun. Leslie, anything you wanted to add to that?
No. I think that having that type of situation with watch parties to show this device, you really need to feel it, to be able to understand exactly how it works. So that is fabulous with the watch parties. And we have them, the devices, but we have, I think, five of them at the Kings games. But I was, you know, wondering about how do we get them to get more? Because there are several blind fans that, you know, that I know of that were waiting for the devices and didn't get to use them certain times.
Yeah. But it's a great question. We are always encouraging teams to up the quantity of devices, because we keep record of how often they're used, and not only utilization rates, but also the number of games where people didn't get a device because the demand was so high. And something that I think the sports teams are realizing is that you may have a few nights where only a few fans are there. Maybe you have two or three devices used out of five. But more often, people want to come with friends and family. People want to travel to the game in groups and enjoy it with other people, because sports is such a community experience. And so more often, there's more people than devices that are requesting it. And so the best way, honestly, is a two-prong approach, I would say. One, contacting your local teams and letting them know and saying, hey, have you heard of One Quart? If you don't have One Quart, when is your team planning to get One Quart devices? At this point in time, I would say most teams know what One Quart is, and a good portion of them are already in discussion with us. So anytime a fan reaches out and advocates for these devices to be available, that's very helpful. And then the second part is joining our wait list, because we're able to look at those numbers and we say, hey, X number of fans that are local to this area or are huge supporters of this team want this device. And so we're also doing the advocating on our side as well.
Great. That's perfect, because that's what I think people need to realize is go to your guest services or your team people and tell them what you want, and that you really want this device, and that's the way to get it put in more venues everywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, that's how you got the radio, right? Your radio mm-hmm. stopped working, and then you were able to get
yes live. We told them that this was not acceptable. If we were season ticket holders, we needed to be able to get the feed somehow. And the next game, they had it working.
Well, Bree and Leslie, we still have time, so I wonder if we can open it up for questions to start with. And it's very intriguing sounding. So do we have any raised hands?
Yep, you have 7 of them.
Ooh, okay.
So we're gonna start with area code 916 ending in 307. You can go ahead.
This is Jim Fano, and I have 2 questions. The first one is you mentioned about your plan in the near future to start having this integrated through streaming at people's residence or possibly, you know, at sports bars. Can you tell us something about the advocacy work that you and other groups that are working with you are doing with the Federal Communications Commission to get satellite providers like DirecTV to carry this tactile thing? I'm a user, I have DirecTV, and right now they won't even carry audio description. They say we don't have to do it, and we're not going to do it. And yet they have the networks that you will carry, the networks that will be streaming your tactile thing. And I'm wondering what you're going to be, what kind of work is going on behind the scenes that you can share about changing the regulations to require that entities like Dish and DirecTV provide that. The other question is, what is the long-term picture in terms of going beyond sports in the use of this technology that you've developed? And thank you. I look forward to your answers.
Yeah, great questions. So on the advocacy front, we know there are groups like ACB that are already working on this advocacy piece of, one, live sports being more accessible, but two, broadcasters making their broadcasts more accessible. So we don't want to be replicating work. We want to be working together on that. On our front, we've found success working directly with the sports teams and making either their broadcasts more accessible. For example, with MLB, they have their MLB TV, or they have the MLB app, for example. How can we make that more accessible because we're already partnering with them? Another example, which nothing has been formalized yet, but for example, Paramount. Like Paramount Plus has expressed interest in seeing how we can make the broadcast more accessible and include something like One Court. So these are all very early exploratory conversations, but it's definitely important to us.
And the Paramount Plus is something that is definitely carried by DirecTV. And what is, and the thought is then, the other question is, going beyond sports, do you have any idea what your technology could be adapted to?
Yeah, there are so many ideas that community members have shared with us. Everything from live concerts to plays to race car. I know racing is still sport and dance is still sport even, but different forms of sport, not your classic court and ball. We've talked about gaming, having games on the surface of the device. So I think there's lots of opportunities to expand beyond. Sports is just the beginning.
Then I will get off. I would suggest trying a air shows, like Blue Angels or Thunderbirds, just using them as an example. And
yeah,
that is multiple things at the same time, high in the sky, but that would make air shows a lot more accessible and exciting. They were already exciting, but having that. So thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate this presentation.
All right. So your next hand is going to be Robert Acosta.
I don't know. Number one, how does the team contact One Court? You're going to give us contact information, I hope. Secondly, Leslie, if there is a challenge on a player, a foul, how much do you get to see? I mean, are they going to say, oh, there's LeBron's elbow in the guy's face? Or sometimes they'll say, LeBron did a 360 degree spin. Does the ball spin? And they say on the radio, that's LeBron spinning. I'm not clear on that.
No. Right now, we don't we don't have that information as
okay.
far as
on, you will.
They've talked about it and they have the information, but Bree will explain that. I think at this point, it's just where the ball is and where it's heading to and what, and where it's thrown, you know.
Leslie, can you see a play being developed? You'd have to know the play if they said number four and they, you know,
right now they don't.
Can you see it develop or just follow the ball?
Just right now, it's just following.
Okay.
That's why the broadcast.
Good.
Is
yes.
there with it to help at this point? And I know Bree will tell you about how they're planning. There's other things they can do with the players, but at this point, we don't know which player has the ball. We just know it's coming to our side of the court and where it's at exactly on the court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just want to conclude by saying that this is a wonderful idea and that our nice lady sounds terrific. And I hope I'll be able to see the day when USC beats Stanford with the dots going back and forth. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for the support. Just to quickly add to what Leslie said, currently the radio broadcast is going to give that detailed commentary of the play. There's two ways that we could start to incorporate that. We could either stream the radio directly through the device. So a fan could choose if they're listening to the radio or one court commentary. We can't do that yet, but something we're exploring. And then the second one is having fan profiles. So maybe Leslie doesn't want the detailed commentary. She just wants to know who has the ball and what's happening. Or versus maybe someone really wants a detailed commentary of everything that's happening. How can we support both those experiences so a fan could customize the audio that they're receiving, the level of detail? So those are two ways we're exploring right now.
All right. Okay. You have seven hands. I don't know how long
it's just a little after three, and mm-hmm. Originally we were going to go until four. So
okay.
Let's go ahead and do a few more. And then I'd like to ask a couple questions as well when they're finished, if they haven't been answered yet.
All right. So we're going to have Diane followed by Nelly.
Hi. Let's see. Does it work with hockey?
Ah, yes. Hockey is the next sport that we are developing on the device. We just recently started to get access to NHL data. I'm a huge hockey fan, so I'm advocating hard for
that. Yeah. And the San Jose Sharks, the arena is only about 10 to 15 minutes away from me, so that'd be really cool. And the Warriors, it's up in San Francisco. Their arena is a little farther, and it'd be harder for me to get to by myself. But the Sharks, I could easily go by myself if I wanted to. And with this, I probably would, because mm-hmm. not a lot of people in my family like hockey. a few of them do, but yeah. I love it. And that'd be great for to have something like this to go, to a game, have it at a game. And then I imagine, so when the play's going one way, and then the dots will be going the one way, and then when then they'll go back the other way. Is that how that works?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then there would be some type of audio cue that there's a change in possession from team to team.
Oh, so you wear like a headset or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Forgot about you. You wear an actual headset. And what I do is I get the receiver, and I have one earbud in one ear, and I put the headset over that, so I'm listening to the broadcast and also the one court device at the same time.
Then Leslie, do you take your not to interrupt, sorry, do you take your own radio to the game, or do you use one that they provide?
Not anymore because the broadcast wouldn't go through into the arena for some reason a couple of years ago. It started not happening. So that's when they have receivers at the arena that I go and request, and they'll give me it, and it's set on one of their program channels. We also have audio description at the arena, So these are the receivers that you would use for that as well. And they have one station program to the radio feed.
Oh, cool. Okay. Thank you. I'll let the next person go. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Diane, let's stay in touch. The sharks are on our list. So.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. Definitely. Awesome. Wow.
Sounds great.
Thanks.
All right. So we are going to have Nellie followed by Jamie.
Wow. This is so exciting. I think it's wonderful. Jean's idea of, a possibility of being able to access an air show sometime in the future would be just amazing. I am an airplane aficionado, and I'm very proud of the fact that the planes of fame are moving to Santa Maria, California, so they will be like 3 miles away. But the question I wanted to ask is, have you had any interest in horse racing? Like in California, the horse racing in Del Mar and in Santa Anita Racetrack, has there been any interest in that?
Yeah, we've actually had racetracks reach out to us. My colleague Alexa, she manages all of our sports and business partnerships. She has been approached before, both from race car racetracks and horse racetracks to see.
Oh.
Even sailing races off the coast. Off
oh, wow.
Coast of California. So I think there are so many applications to the haptics to describe live gameplay of any type, really. So I think for us, our first question is always what data is currently being captured. When it comes to things like horse races or car races, that data is already being collected. And so then it's a matter of how do we translate that onto the device? And then who do we work with at the racetrack or the league level to bring this technology to light? And I would say right now, the demand for applications on where the technology could go is outpacing our team's ability to service those sports and those entertainment pieces. So it's an exciting place to be, and we know that we want to keep growing.
Yeah, I would imagine that there would be a tremendous interest in that. In 2024, I went to the Cal State University Northridge International Technology Conference, and I saw a device. I don't know if it was one court, but it was something demoing what you have described, where a person can place their hands on a device and actually feel the layout of the racetrack and the movement through vibration as to where the cars were going. So I don't know if you guys were there, if that was somebody else that has a similar device, but I thought that was really great.
Wow. Yeah, maybe it was someone else. We were at CSUN, the Assistive Tech Conference, this year in 2025, but we don't have a prototype yet for racing. So maybe we have a partner out there that we can find.
Yeah, there's somebody else out there already doing it. I didn't go this year, but keep up the good work. This is great. Thank you.
Thank you, Nellie.
All right. So we're going to have Jimmy followed by Shauna.
Did you mean Jamie?
Oh, Jamie. Sorry. Yes. I'm sorry.
No problem. Oh, thank you so much. Oh, man, I'm so excited about this. So I have a couple questions really quick. How do you join the wait list? When you do join the wait list, are we like, we have statuses about maybe those teams or team? And then what the progress is or how soon or whatever. And then on the device itself, you were talking about the headsets. And I want to know if the headsets the device, instead of it using a headset, is it compatible where it can be connected to our smart hearing aids?
Mm-hmm. Two great questions. I can talk to the wait list, and then Leslie, I see maybe you want to jump in too. The best way to join our wait list is by visiting our website. So that's onecourt, onecourt.io. That's the best way. You can join on the homepage, or we have a for home section of the website where you can join our wait list there. And it'll give you the option to opt into our monthly newsletters. Those will be regular communication from our team that give updates on what we're up to, teams we're working with, any fun updates we can share. And then we will also send email blasts out specifically to where you're located. So if you choose to share your city, your state, and your favorite sports teams with us, then we'll also reach out when those opportunities arise. On the device side, fans are currently welcome to bring their own headset if they wish. So they could bring earbuds or over-ear headphones, but they do require that 3.5 millimeter audio jack to plug into the device. We're hopeful in the future that we'll be able to implement Bluetooth technology. So it could be your smart hearing aids. It could be AirPods. It could be your favorite Bluetooth set that you can connect to the device. But we don't currently have that set up yet.
Okay, thank you. And then my last question is, when are you going to get the Dallas Cowboys up?
Woo-hoo. Oh, that's a great question. I mean, the Dallas Cowboys are such a franchise, right? Everybody knows them, whether they're from Dallas or not. So they'd be a dream team for us to work with for sure.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to have Shauna followed by Stephanie.
Hi, this is Shayna. My question is, how exactly does it work as far as all the different ways that it's haptic, of course, but how does it feel like when somebody makes a basket as opposed to someone just going down the court towards a basket, or how is that displayed, or for lack of a better word?
Mm-hmm. I'll start to describe and then Leslie, feel free to jump in. Mm-hmm. So we vary the intensity, the duration, and the pattern of the vibrations. So currently your cell phone, for example, has one of these motors in it. But when it vibrates, it could vibrate with different patterns, but really mm-hmm. it vibrates the whole phone. When we vibrate the motors, they're really small. Each individual motor is probably about smaller than your pinky nail. And so when you feel it underneath your in your hands, in your palms, you can pinpoint exactly in your palm or on your hand where that vibration is happening. It's really, really localized. So you can imagine it's almost like someone drawing a line across your palm. The vibrations of the motors are going to draw a path underneath your hands so that you can feel that ball moving across the court. And then we vary the vibration. So it's a really strong vibration when they take the shot, and then a really strong vibration when it hits the hoop, whether they make it or they miss. And then in football, we switch to football. A touchdown is going to feel like a really strong vibration of the whole end zone, versus a tackle is going to feel like a really specific point on the board is vibrating and it'll pulse. So there's a little bit of a learning curve to learn what each of those patterns mean, but that's why pairing it with the audio is really helpful, because you have audio description of what those plays are and what those haptic vibrations mean.
Thank you.
And also the vibrations, they move very quickly, so you get used to, you know, following them. And like I said, when I feel the vibrations and it's going real fast to the basket, it's right there. It's like you can't really tell if it goes in the basket. Like she said, it's when it comes, it hits the basket but the movement, I mean, you definitely can feel it, because the basket is a little tiny round circle and at one spot in the on the court, and on the lines that you feel, there's a dotted line, and this is tactily, you feel it physically on the board, and you can tell that the ball, where it is in those lines or outside of them, if it's not on your side, there's you can tell when the ball is coming and where it is. And also, one of the things that I was not aware of, and it kind of parts to this, the one at one point the the vibrations were right under the basket, and they were, it was on a pause. It was on a timeout, I guess, getting ready for somebody to shoot a free throw. Well, I didn't know that what they did, where was the ball when somebody's getting ready to throw? They're not holding it, you know, and I didn't know whether they were holding the ball, getting ready to shoot, or what. Well, I found out that under the basket is where the umpire was standing with the ball in hand. So he was waiting to throw it to the player who was going to shoot. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. Now I understand that. Why was that area vibrating? Well, because that's where the ball was. And I was really, you know, fascinated on after that, looking during the timeouts and stuff and see where exactly the ball is. So it's quite interesting.
All right. So we're going to have Stephanie followed by area code 650 ending in 688.
Yes. Good afternoon. Thank you so much. This presentation warms my heart because I love sports. I am especially a baseball fan. True confession here, I live in Sacramento and I love my city in a lot of ways, but I am a passionate Dodger fan. So hopefully one court is doing everything they can to work with the Dodgers. That said, I'm wondering, once the subscription portion of your experience becomes live, will we be able to access out-of-market games in that? And then I have I have an additional question once you've finished the first answer. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, first thing I'll say is if you're a Dodgers fan, email Dodgers guest experience, because the Dodgers are in discussions with us right now, and any nudge from community helps.
So that would be Dodgers guest experience, all lowercase, at dodgers.com? Or
I can confirm with you after, Stephanie. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Of course.
Yeah, thank you. I'll find out the exact email.
Yeah, I have to have them. I must. Awesome. I love my friends up here with Giants fans. And this is my home. I've been here over 30 years now. But yeah, once a Dodger, always a Dodger. That yep, anyway, awesome. They're going to kill me later in the hospitality for that one. But my other comment, and I'll be...
The question about the at-home experience?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that subscription, we're currently working with both NBA, MLB, and NFL to figure out what that home subscription would look like.
Okay.
From their perspective, they want to open up the game. They want to make it more accessible. So they haven't mentioned anything to us about out-of-market, in-market restrictions. The goal that we're negotiating towards, and negotiating seems like a heavy word, it's really partnership with them. Mm-hmm. We're working with them towards is having a full season, every game, every team streamed on the device for one price for a year. And that price, we're aiming for it to be anywhere between $100 and $150 for a package of either one team or multiple teams, or sorry, one sport or multiple sports.
So I'll take gift cards and gifts from all my friends out there in CCB. My last question is, I know we have no doubt people, I won't just say young people, but people who are perhaps in college studying one thing and another who might want to be interns with one court. Can you speak to that and how they might apply?
Yeah.
I thank you so much. You and Leslie, thank you. Take me to a Kings game, please.
I invited you.
I know. I missed that one, but we'll do another one. Thank
we'll
you
do
so
it
much.
Again.
We'll do it again. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Your question on internships. So I first got involved with One Court as a student at the University of Washington. I was doing my master's and I heard about One Court and I just asked to get involved. And so I started volunteering and then eventually moved into a full-time role. And we have a mixture of folks on our team. We have sighted folks. We have a user experience designer who has been blind since birth, and he designs everything from our main menu to interactions to how the haptics feel on the surface. And we currently have a social media intern that just started with us a few weeks ago. So I think as we continue to grow as a team, there will be more and more opportunities for folks to get involved. And I think a common thread across everyone that works at One Chord is that we believe that sport should be for everyone. And so if there's folks that are aligned with that vision, I encourage them to reach out, because you never know what opportunity might come up.
And again, is that website onecourt.com?
Onecourt.io.
I'm sorry, .io. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
All right, so we have area code 650 ending in 688, and following them is going to be Donna Pomerantz.
Now, do I really get to talk? I don't believe this. I never dreamed that there'd be this much of a congregation of sports psychotics as we seem to have here. What I'm interested in is what this is telling us about how people perceive things. And I've been a psychology graduate student and so forth, and it's frustrating to me that practically everything we know about perception is visual, not even auditory. I mean, auditory there's some, but tactile, and I'm glad you used the term haptic, because I learned that from one of my professors. We don't know anything about how the body takes in information about what's going on around it and so forth, and how where it is. And this sounds like it might be going toward that. Somebody once asked me how a blind person can play the piano. And I thought, well, now that's an interesting thing to wonder about, because you have to know, your brain has to know where your fingers are to do that.
Roger, did you have a question?
We don't know how that works. So,
do you have a question?
Hey, I asked my question. Goodbye.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're going to have Donna Pomerantz followed by area code 970 ending in 874.
Hi there. Mitch and I got to experience the device at the CSUN conference. So I believe it was yourself that we met. And Mitch was real excited about baseball, because he is definitely an avid Dodgers fan. In fact, he's over there in his man cave and recliner listening to Dodgers pregame show right now. So but I had just wanted to, you know, say that it's very exciting, the possibility of knowing exactly where the ball is at, you know, in proximity to the next area and so on and so forth. And just want to thank you for what you're doing. And just for me to reconfirm that email, no, I'm sorry, that website is court onecourt.io, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think I actually have Mitch's email.
Oh, yes, he gave it to you. Yes, yes.
Yeah, you and Mike are on our wait list already. So
awesome.
I remember meeting you both at Pomerantz is familiar.
Yes, and Mike, Mitch is the one that steered Mike over there to go and find you guys before they left. So that's awesome. We can't wait to hear about the Dodgers. Woohoo! Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to have area code 970 ending in 874. And Livy is going to follow that person.
That'll be the last. Livy will be the last.
Hi, this is Catherine Johnson, and I'm in Colorado. But I'm a CCB member, and I like baseball, but I don't get to go too often. So I'm really excited about this device and finding out more about it. Do you think that it could be used as a teaching tool to learn about, I don't know anything about soccer or anything about rugby, but I wanted to learn. And my nephew taught me everything I know about hockey, and he was my announcer at the two hockey matches that I've gone to. But it would be wonderful to take this device. Do you have to talk to them ahead of time when you are going to a live hockey game, for example? Thank you.
I love that you brought that up. I forgot to talk about that as another use case. I'm so excited about the opportunity for education and teaching. I think I've heard from a lot of fans that say I didn't think sport was for me because I didn't fully understand how the game went. And so not only through the tactile interface that we have that has the court dimensions and the field of play, I'd love to have it as a teaching tool or even a coaching tool. So you can imagine you have a goal ball team at an elementary school or a high school level, and you're teaching plays of goal ball. Can you imagine having a coach have a device and draw out a play on, let's say, an iPad, and then that vibrates on the device and they can feel what that play is supposed to feel like? Cool. That's just one example, but I would love for us to expand into teaching and coaching and education, because I think understanding sport is one of the first steps to be able to enjoy sport and all that it has to offer. So absolutely. And then you talked about letting a venue know ahead of time. So currently, we need to have an agreement set up with the specific teams in order to bring devices into that venue. And then from a fan perspective, once devices are there, all you have to do is contact guest services ahead of time and they'll set a device aside for you. Or you could walk in if one is still available and check it out. And then eventually when we have the at-home device, you could stream every day from the comfort of your sofa if you had your own.
Thank you very much for answering those questions. I'm excited to look into it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and our last hand is Livy.
My question is, have you considered the Olympics? That's about the only sports that I like to watch. And unfortunately, I have an old TV, and it does not have audio description. So if we ever get a new TV, that'll be great. But would that be a possibility in the future?
I mean, LA 28 is just around the corner, so it's definitely on our radar. We would love to support both the Olympics and the Paralympic Games. It's important for us that if we were to be able to support the Games, we would do both. And then figuring out what sports, there's so many para sports, figuring out which sports that we'd want to try in our first debut at the Olympic level. And Paralympic level, because I think it would be quite a feat to do every single para sport that will be at the 2028 games. But we want to be there, and we're starting those discussions already.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, all right. Well, thank you, Bree, and thank you, Leslie, for an excellent presentation. I'm a big Dodgers fan myself and would love to get a feel for the movement of the ball and everything. So
awesome. Thank really, you so much for really, having us.
One thing I wanted to
go ahead, Dustin.
It's interesting because I used to, when you know, we have two tickets, and a couple months ago, Jeff couldn't go and I couldn't find anybody to come with me at the last minute. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go anyway, because before I would have been like, oh, I don't want to go by myself. I don't want to do that. You know, I'm just sitting there, no one to talk to or whatever. Now I have something to focus on. And so I was just like, wow, okay. It doesn't matter where somebody's going or not. I'm going because I've got something to look forward to. And I can concentrate on this. And it really was great. It was really good.
So. Well, thank you. Thank you, too, again, for a very good presentation. All right. We're going to move forward here. And the next thing on the agenda is a chapter of the year.
Well, I think we have two more, right?
Presentation.
There's two more, right?
Larry is available.
Hello, everybody. This is Pamela Metz, and I'm chair of the Sunshine Committee with the Los Angeles chapter of the California Council of the Blind. And we believe in paying it forward. The Greater Los Angeles chapter members have been paying it forward and donating foods and goods and clothes throughout the Los Angeles area for years. The Greater Los Angeles chapter believes that what we have, we can share, and what someone else needs, we can share. During the fires, I donated food and clothes to the San Fernando Mission and had them sent to the mission in Los Angeles to give goods to the people who were affected by the fires. Hello again, my name is Pamela Metz, and I'm chair of the Sunshine Committee for the Greater Los Angeles Chapter of the California Council of the Blind.
All right. Thank you, Pam.
I think we have another one, don't we, for today?
One more.
One more.
Yes, do one more.
Play that.
All right.
Our chapter, the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind, is proud of the strides that we have made to support the blind and low vision community. We have 63 active members, and this membership continues to grow every year. And the reason for this is that our members actively invite others to join in on our chapter meetings. Our monthly programs include membership offerings, where our members share their tips, their tricks, their personal stories, and also their achievements. We also have weekly meetings where individuals check in to problem solve, to lend support, and most importantly, share lighthearted humor. For years, we have produced a monthly newsletter, the InTouch newsletter, that circulated to our members and to our greater community. This outreach helps us to keep members informed, to promote involvement. Being in Silicon Valley, we believe that it's important that we have a presence, and our website is to help us to promote the work that we do and to encourage our supporting government and city entities to learn about SVCB and CCB. One of the basic foundations of our chapter is mentorship and leadership. We actively support new members and learn about ways to be involved. This includes community work, running for the board, and leading task team. We believe in giving back. For over 15 years, we have funded our annual technology grant. Individuals age 16 and older have been awarded grants that help them to pursue their academic, their career, and their individual quality of life goals. We also regularly donate to causes that promote the quality of life for the blind and low vision community. And an example of this is our annual sponsorship of the Braille Challenge. Social gatherings also help our members to bring their families, their friends, and their colleagues into our network, including our annual picnic, our holiday party, and our annual old-time radio event. Our work is not just about today. It's about building a better and more inclusive and accessible future for all involved.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I'm glad we played that one, or I'd be in real trouble. So, Silicon Valley, there you go.
Glad I was able to save you.
All right, well, our final item is going to be, well, after door prize, we'll have announcements. And we'll be ready for our banquet that'll start at 5 on regular Zoom. So, Lisa, are you available to do another drawing?
I'm still here.
Great.
So we're going to do a $25 Amazon gift card from CCB. And the winner is David Jackson. Congratulations, David.
Hey, Mr. DJ, way to go. All right, so let's go ahead and now open up to any closing announcements.
Sure. Thank you guys for your active participation today. So I have gone ahead and sent out the emails for the link for the banquet, which is going to be on regular Zoom. Pretty soon here, I'm going to send out the link for the hospitality suite and where that's going to be located. So be looking for your email on that around the 5 o'clock hour. So you should be receiving that pretty soon here. So thanks to everybody. Thanks to our presenters. And thanks to our Zoom host, Natalie, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the streamer's name. I'm blanking.
It's Rick Morin.
Oh, it is Rick Morin. Hello, mm-hmm. Rick. Well, thank you, Rick, for streaming and staying with us. And we are in recess till the banquet.
All right. See everybody at 5:00.